everyone. This is John.
And this is Ryan. And
this is the Nickel Film Podcast, episode 43, the movie podcast of Gamers Anonymous. If this is your first time listening, thanks for joining us. You can download previous episodes on iTunes. Just do a search for Gamers Anonymous. There you will also find our other podcasts, The Nintendo Show, as well as The John and Carlo Show. And you can always listen to previous episodes on our website, www.gamersunanimous.com. On today's show, we're going to be reviewing the new film, The Artist, as well as talking about what's coming out on DVD and list our top five anachronisms. But first, Ryan, what have you been watching?
I got two movies on tap to talk about, one of which we brought up when we did our best of 2011. Not that it made the list, but just that it was one that I did want to talk about, so I figured we can give it a full review.
Very good.
It's Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And, I actually have not watched that one yet, but I'm interested in hearing what you think about it.
Well, it's an interesting movie, I guess. It's Sean Durkin. I believe this is his debut. This is the first movie he's made. And it stars Elizabeth Olsen. It's sort of, she's the main character of it, and it centers around her escape from a cult.
Right.
And it's just watching how they kind of abused her and then kind of screwed with her mind. And the movie kind of follows her as she's trying to assimilate herself back into the normal world. And she does so by, briefly moving in with her sister and brother-in-law, her husband. And it's kind of like it's very on the nose with this message about this whole thing, because you can see that from the way it's going with her sister, that she's equally oppressive, but in a different way. Like, she's trying to impose all of these rules and standards, and it's clear that they're, because they live this very kind of opulent lifestyle. They have like a ton of money, and like when she does move in with them, they're living at like their, I don't know, it's like their summer estate. It's like this beautiful mansion on this lake. And she just sees them, even though she's like this totally broken young girl, she still sees them as like these people that are just obsessed with wealth and doesn't really want to have any part of it. But ultimately, like, I don't know, I don't think this was really a great movie. I think that there's some very pretty shots every once in a while. I think they're maybe they feel a little showy, if I could say anything. But then also sometimes there's like really bad flubs. Like, there's one scene where you can actually see crew in the background, like walking around.
What?
Like, it is a terrible, and this is obvious, like it's a dinner scene. And there's like, they're sitting there, and if you just look in the background, you see people walking around. And it's like, not like it's supposed to be people are sneaking around their house. They're just actual crew.
Like the caterers, or like a guy holding a boom mic?
No, it's like you see some shadows of people like back there. Like, and there's a lot of, like, there's not mirrors, but there's like windows. You see like boom mics reflecting off of windows. Like the first time, and maybe I'm being a little over analytical, but the first time I actually saw somebody in the background that was actually part of the crew, I think I just started noticing everything about it.
Yeah, that's, I don't know, that's something, if you are going to consider yourself a filmmaker, that's, like, the two of the things you gotta do. You don't show any of the, you watch your windows and mirrors, and you make sure no one's poking a boom mic into frame.
And that's exactly it, because it's a good-looking movie for the most part. It's just weird to see such sloppy mistakes in it. Because otherwise, it's actually fantastically shot. There's a lot of really good.
There are no shots out of focus or anything?
No. I mean, they got that under control, at least. I think that there's also some problem with the, like, again, Elizabeth Olsen's performance is fantastic. She's amazing in this movie. She shows incredible emotional range within it. But, I mean, ultimately, I don't really see, well, I think there could have been interesting things about the movie that they chose not to focus on. Like, mainly what it's like being in the cult. Like, you see clips of it every once in a while, and they give you, like, they just basically show you all of these people as just, like, troubled young people that are struggling with some kind of addiction that are trying to work their way through it with this program that this guy's established. But he's also incredibly crazy and controlling. Like, he gives them, that's the whole, the title of the movie, why she has so many names, is because Martha is her real name, but Marcy May is the name that this cult leader gives her. But you never really at any point see what makes this guy such a compelling or commanding figure. I was going to say, because it reminds me a little bit of what we liked about Red State with the Aben character.
Uh-huh.
You understood why he was so charismatic. This guy's not very charismatic at all. He's just kind of crazy, and he's got this weird fetish for raping young women, and it's very dark, but they don't explain why exactly this guy is this compelling leader.
It's a very fine line you walk between having someone who's both very clearly psychotic as well as captivating, and just someone who's just so psychotic that they're repelling. And I think that's something we both liked about Red State, but it sounds like there was nothing that made this guy interesting, or like
nothing
made you want to watch him.
I was interested to know more about what the cult life was like, but we just see it in... The story is actually kind of non-linear, and I think that's done to show how jarred her mind is and how confused she is, because it jumps around, and there is these kind of smooth transitions from the past to the present that take place when she sees something that kind of connects the two worlds. But, like, it's really bizarrely handled at times. And I will say, this is actually another one of those movies. Like, it seems like a lot of movies this year ends with kind of a button ending. We're like, where the hell is this going to go next? Because it may very well be that they have come back to get her. And it's like, that would have been so cool. I wanted to see 30 more minutes in the movie, but they decided that's when it was best to stop it.
All right, well...
So ultimately, yeah, don't... Yeah, I mean, it's not... It's a movie that's going to get a ton of, you know, praise, and I don't know if it's entirely justified.
Well, I got that one on tap to talk about next week. I'm going to watch it, and...
let me know what you think.
Yeah, we'll see. Maybe we'll have a little bit of a further discussion. But I've seen a bunch of movies I don't want to talk about real quick. I saw The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the new David Fincher movie.
Oh, yeah?
And it's an adequate mystery flick with this penchant for brutality. There's multiple rape scenes. I mean, there's two, according to a lot of people. I can only really remember one, though.
Yeah.
It'd be really strange to have a forgettable rape scene, but apparently this movie pulled it off.
Yeah. Well, it's nice that we're getting all of our rape movies out of the way early.
Right. That's the connection between the two here.
Yeah.
There's lots of other violence, you know, people getting shot and blown up and punched in the face and that kind of stuff. Rooney Mara stars as the titular girl with the dragon tattoo, Elizabeth. She is really intense and really committed to this role, and by that I mean there's lots of nudity.
Mm-hmm.
And she's really interesting to watch. She's the most interesting character in the movie, as she probably should be, but they do a good job of making you want to know more about her. She's a person who puts up these walls, and there's this this question throughout the movie that's very subtly hinted at, whether she is actually as crazy and antisocial as she is acting, or if it is just this act that she's putting on. She wants people to think that she's crazy and antisocial, because that's the only way she knows how to interact with the world.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel Craig is also in this movie, and he is solving this murder. He goes to this island in like off the coast of Sweden, or you know, with like a moat around it or whatever, because they like the only time you see water is like when he's crossing this bridge, and there's like a little dock as well.
Yeah.
So on this island, there's this guy who hires him to solve the disappearance of his niece like 40 years prior.
Mm-hmm.
So he goes to this island and decides to solve this murder mystery because the guy who hired him claims to have information about this sort of wealthy businessman. I'm not quite sure what this businessman does, but Daniel Craig and this businessman had like a little spat. Daniel Craig is a journalist, wrote some things about this businessman. The businessman took him to court and sued him for libel and won. So Daniel Craig, it's kind of like his redemption story. He's trying to solve this one murder mystery in order to get information about this other thing that he's tied up into, and it's just as convoluted as it sounds.
Yeah.
At a certain point in the movie, you know, you're wondering why you are interested in this murder mystery, and it's pretty easy to get wrapped up in it because, you know, it's a murder mystery. It's interesting to see them investigate. And there's a nice contrast of these investigation scenes between, like, the analog. Like, Daniel Craig is always, like, looking through photos, and there's scenes of, like, going to libraries and going through archives. And there's also a nice mesh with technology. Mm-hmm. They have, internet things, and he's, like, scanning photos and slide-showing them together. So it's a really cool mix of the two.
Hmm.
But it's... You lose the momentum when that one story comes to a resolution, and then they have to wrap up the other half, which you haven't seen anything of in a while. And I really didn't care why he wanted to get even or clear his name with this businessman. The that part of the story had just completely lost traction altogether, and it just felt like this extra part tagged in there. Mm-hmm. So the whole movie is basically a side story. Like, there's this guy who wants to clear his name, and he has to do so by solving this murder mystery. And it all, you know, feels a little bit inconsequential, but it's at least interesting to see him investigate this thing.
Well, I mean, this is going to be a series of movies. Is this, do you think, part of some overarching story that...
I think so.
This is just sort of the centerpiece of the first
I think
first
so.
Part of it.
And I'm interested to see if, taking this series forward, if they have callbacks to this murder mystery, if it has some other purpose into, like, a larger story rather than just something he has to solve in order to get information. And I'm going to spoil this movie for about 20 seconds. So starting right now, if you don't want this movie spoiled, skip ahead 20 seconds. The entire murder mystery, this information that he wants to get, has no importance. He basically gets it and says, this is shit, I can't use it. So everything he just did was completely pointless. And we're coming to the end. It was really unsatisfying, but we're coming to the end of spoilers now, okay. So I'm going to go ahead and stop.
Yeah.
It was just really surprising
Sounds
to me.
Lame.
Yeah. it was pretty lame. Yeah. So there's also this odd romance that evolves between Rooney Mara and Daniel Craig, and it was strange how they kind of got together. He hires her because she was investigating him for the rich businessman, and she did such a good job. He's like, "Hey, I'm going to bring you on and help me to help me solve this murder." And then all of a sudden, one day, they're like, "Hey, we should fuck." So they do.
I just DTF.
Yeah,
and that's good.
And he's kind of the one sort of normal relationship that she has. So it's interesting to kind of see her like treading these waters that she's really unfamiliar with.
Yeah.
But again, it's all pretty inconsequential. So it's a fun movie. It's not worth going out to the movie theater to see. This one's
is it a good looking movie?
Yeah, it's a nice looking movie. It's very cold. Everything takes place during winter because apparently it's perpetually winter in Sweden. But they also hint at a timeline here. He's like been investigating for a year, but it's always fucking snowing. So yeah, there's that, and yeah, there's a lot of really cool shots. The performances are all adequate. This isn't a movie that you're gonna get the most out of, like catching it on cable one day. They're gonna edit the shit out of it. So this one's a DVD or a Blu-ray rental.
Okay.
Also, real quick, I wanted to mention one that you've also seen. You talked about before. It's Moneyball.
Oh, very good. Did you like it?
I did. I liked it. I thought it was an oversimplification of sabermetrics philosophy. So they put so much emphasis on on-base percentage in this movie. I'm not really well-versed in, you know, what they were actually thinking at the time back in 2002, about how they were trying to reshape this team. But it seems like they ignore these things like defense. Like there's
well, they say it now that, I mean, even though the Athletics in recent years haven't been that great, they said they've been one of the best, or from what I was reading, one of the best defensive teams consistently.
Yeah.
Like, even if they're not good on offense, they're always, like, really stout on defense.
Which is interesting, because in this movie, they take the complete opposite. They bring in guys who are statistically awful defenders, and they say it doesn't matter as long as they get on base, when run prevention is... I don't think it's just as important as run scoring, but it's pretty darn close to be able to stop the other team from scoring and to be able to play competent defense. But they seem
well, it seems like you'd also have to be a lot more elegant in how you are able to get it. Because, I mean, it's a lot easier if you're taking these stats out of batting because it's so immediate.
Yeah.
But really, I mean, you could compile a team of Gold Glove winners and they might not be that great when you think of them in a batting order as well. So
sure, yeah. And yeah, and let's get into the actual movie here.
Did you like what they got out of some of the performances in there?
I did. I liked Brad Pitt as Billy Bean. He's on a really interesting journey. This whole on-base percentage crusade he's on is basically he's trying to justify his own failure as a Major League Baseball player. And they show flashbacks of him, you know, signing with the Mets and having these playing with these different teams and not being very successful at all. But he's basically the scouts that he was talking to were very highly praising him. You know, a five tools player.
Oh, yeah, that's going to be amazing. Yeah,
you're going to be a star. But he's basically trying to justify his failure because the scouts were looking at him in the wrong way. So he's trying to find value in undervalued guys, and by doing so, devalue the traditionally valued guys, and kind of vindicating himself a little bit there. And it was a really interesting angle to take, and I like that part of it a lot.
Well, it was really sad too, because I remember, I was also when I was looking it up, he played on at least one, I think maybe a couple World Series winning teams, but he was not like active. He wasn't one of the starting players.
Much.
Yeah, so he just like, he didn't really, he was there for it. He watched other people win, but he never did it himself.
And he's always trying to chase that win the last game of the season. They spell it out pretty plainly. But I really like some of the rapid pace discussions. You can see Aaron Sorkin kind of all over those scenes, especially that rapid pace trade scene where they're trying to acquire.
I love that scene.
Rincon. Yeah, it's a really fantastic scene, and he's like playing different.
See, of course,
people.
You love him.
Yeah, and then but it's a little bit. It's not anticlimactic because the climax of the scene is when they finally get the player, but you don't ever see the fruits of their labor in an actual game. Like, you see this guy pitch and he's this amazing reliever and he's what's putting them over the hump to get, you know, where they need to be as a team. You don't really see a whole lot of games in general until close to the end of the movie, where you have this montage of basically their season. And really rapid pace, you know, they go on
winning streak, but then go on the massive winning streak.
Yeah, they go on the record-breaking winning streak, and it shies away from showing a lot of in-game stuff, which I think is really bold, because it kind of makes it like a sports underdog movie with very little sports in it.
Yeah.
It's a lot of like the backroom deals, which I thought was a really interesting take.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to throw out about Moneyball?
No, just that I liked it, and it seems like you enjoyed it too.
I did. I really did enjoy it. It was different from what I was kind of expecting, but I liked it.
Okay, cool. All right, then on to my next movie that I wanted to talk about. It's Last Circus. It was a Spanish film that came out last year. Or, well, no, 22 years ago, so 2010. And I really liked this a lot. Have you seen this?
I haven't seen it yet, no.
It's on Netflix, at least last I checked it was on Netflix. It's sort of this very dark and gross and kind of grotesque tale of a love triangle involving two clowns, which is kind of a bizarre description, like a one-line description of the movie, but it's really, they play up just how gruesome this movie is. It starts during, I think, like the late 30s in Spain, kind of at the start of the Spanish Civil War. In the opening sequence, it's so absurd. There's these group of clowns that are trying to entertain these children as war is about to start. And then, like, suddenly the building is, like, starting to shake from explosions all around it. And these militiamen bust in and they're like, well, clowns, you have to fight with us now. You're going to go into war. So they give this one clown a machete and they send him out on the battlefield. And in just this, like, almost slapstick violence, he is just, like, mowing down people, like, soldiers with a machete, like, just hurling himself through this crowd of soldiers. And it's just, it's hilarious to watch. But that's just sort of how the story kickstarts, because that's actually the main character's dad, because he dies at the very end of that sequence. I'm not spoiling anything. This is like for, you know, 10 minutes of the movie. And then the story picks up like, you know, 10, 15 years down the road when the kid has grown up and he decides to honor his father by becoming a clown himself. And the movie presents clowns as sort of pairs, like you have a sad clown and a happy clown, and the happy clown's sort of like the ringleader that controls everything, and the sad clown is sort of the assistant to him. It sort of takes care of things. And this one, it's Carlos Arisias, I think is how you say that. His name's Javier in the story. He's the sad clown that you're kind of following through this. And his boss, the happy clown, is this guy Sergio, played by Antonio De La Torre. And he is, like, crazy and just evil. You see him just brutally beating people all the time. Like, he has this mistress that travels with them, played by Carolina Bing. And he's just always, like, just beating her up. And you see him trying, you see Javier's character, he's trying to be the nice guy and wants to protect her, but ultimately gets all three of them sort of get wrapped up in this very bizarre love triangle. And it's funny to watch it kind of crumble and devolve. Both of them end up disfiguring each other in like these very bizarre accidents, or not accidents, but like outright fights. Like Javier takes off part of the jaw of the happy clown, and then the other one just drives him mad and makes him do all of these crazy things. It's just like this it feels weird to describe this. It's kind of like this weird torture story that happens between these three people and how they're just all so clearly wrong for each other, and yet they can't escape each other.
Very good. What was that one called again?
The Last Circus.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. All right, so we've been going on for a while here, so I'm going to go through these next two pretty rapid fire. I saw another one that you've already talked about, 50-50, mm-hmm. and I found it to be like this really honest examination of the impact of this really deadly illness. I really liked the wide variety of reactions to it. There's the girlfriend who's really standoffish, the best friend who's being real supportive, the mom who just kind of freaks out about it. And I really loved the mom. The actress's name escapes
me. Oh, Angelica Houston.
Angelica Houston.
She's amazing in it.
She's really, really good.
Her and the older friend that the older guy that sort of becomes his friend that's going through it, Philip Baker Hall. Yeah. I think the two best actors in the movie.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it's dealing with a really heavy subject matter, but it's not like grossly sentimental. It really earns the sad moments and really earns a lot of the jokes too. And the jokes land pretty well. I liked that the trailer didn't give away all of the jokes. That seems to happen in a lot of comedies. I think that it's a really good little flick. I think it earns like all of the sentimental moments really well. I think that again all the performances are really good, and I really like 50-50. I think out of the four movies that I'm talking about here today, I think that I liked it the best.
Mm-hmm.
And then also the last one that I saw within the past couple weeks, I saw Red Riding Hood, the new movie with Amanda Seyfried and Gary Oldman, and it is, without a doubt, the most boring werewolf movie I've ever seen.
Yeah.
I can't really say whether it's good or bad because I just kept on going and doing something else and I would come back to it and watch a little bit more. I like the art direction. It has like this really cool goth storybook feel to it, a lot like Terry Gilliam's Brothers Grimm. It's
If you're reaching for art direction, though, it sounds like there's not a lot to be taken out of this.
Right. It's like the one thing this movie might be nominated for, art direction,
okay.
Set design, if that's, I don't think that's a category, costumes. So yeah, Gary Oldman's in it, that's always positive.
Is he playing a werewolf, or is he...
He's like this this priest, this clergyman who comes to the town in order to eradicate the werewolf.
Okay.
Because their town, like the Amanda Seyfried's sister dies, and they decide that it was killed by a wolf, and then he shows up, like, it wasn't a wolf, it was a werewolf. Close the gates, the werewolf is still here. And, the hijinks ensue.
Okay.
So, that's everything I've been watching. Got anything else?
No, that's about it.
Alright, let's go
ahead. Oh, actually, one thing I have been watching, it's not really related to movies, I don't know if you want to break into it now. But somebody just beat the best defense in the NFL.
Let's save that for last. Okay, that's going to be fun.
We'll tease them with that.
All right, so let's take a quick break and come back with our review for The Artist. Artist is a black and white silent film where a man finds, or a silent film actor finds a hard time adjusting to the new sound technologies that are becoming a part of films. What could have been a really by-the-numbers romantic comedy evolves into this interesting character study of the main character, George Valentin, the silent film actor, as he slips into irrelevancy. Most of the charm of the movie emanates from the actress Bernice Bejo, who plays the very aptly named Peppy Miller. Mm-hmm. She just glows in every scene that she's in, and I think she really saves the movie from being this really drab nostalgia trip. So, Ryan, what did you think of The Artist?
All right. Well, I did like this a lot. I think it is a very loving tribute to the silent era of film. The movie looks amazing in black and white. I think you get very emotive, very charismatic performances from the leads. And I think it also helps, at least for me personally. Like, I don't really know the two, is it Jean Desjardins and, how do you pronounce that again? What's her name?
I just thought it was Bernice Bejo.
Bernice Bejo. Yeah, like, I know that she was in A Knight's Tale, but other than that, like, I don't think I've recognized them from anything. So they look like they're just very, very attractive looking actors from the era. So you kind of just get lost in the fact that these might just be these real people.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you. I think it manages to celebrate silent films while simultaneously embracing the importance of changing. I think it'd be impossible to talk about this silent movie without talking about how important the sound actually is.
Oh, yeah.
The music does a really good job setting the tone for each scene. There's also this really interesting scene where the main character is having a harder time finding work. His movie, I believe it's right after this silent film that he directed and produced himself.
It was like Tears of Love?
Something like that. It bombed, and he has this scene where he's in his dressing room alone, and there's no music, and there are sound effects. Like, he's putting a glass down, he hears the glass, he puts a glass down, and they break the fourth wall a little bit, because it's like he's in the silent film and there's also no sound in the world that they're in. So he gets really freaked out by the sound of the glass going down, like when he stands up, the sound of the chair moving.
Yeah, I was wondering how far they would take that. Going in, like, if they were actually going to transition into actual sound throughout the movie, or if it was just going to be a little thing that they did. And they really used it well for that one sequence, right, and sort of in the middle of the movie, where they kind of show him just the shock of experiencing what sound would actually be like on film.
Yeah, but ultimately they didn't really take it anywhere. It was a really interesting moment, and it illustrated well his acknowledging his fear of what sound might be, and like his fear of not knowing if he's still going to be relevant. It was a short sequence of scenes, and then it just kind of went away. And it's one of those sequences, like, oh, it's all a dream, and now things are back to normal. So you mentioned the visual effects. It is a nice looking movie in black and white. There was just the one really interesting scene where they kind of changed the quality of the film.
There's like the dining room scene.
Yeah,
it takes on the sort of a bluish hue to it.
Yeah, no doubt. And you mentioned, like, as we were watching it, or as we finished watching it, rather, that maybe it's a throwback to older black and white movies where, you know, sometimes the visual quality changed because the celluloid has aged.
Kind of like an intentional mistake or, something like that. Just something to give it the feel of being from that era.
Yeah. And what did you think of the, toward the end of the movie, the main character, George, really starts to kind of become a recluse, watching his own movies, like, in his home. It reminded me a little bit of, like, a depiction of Howard Hughes, you know?
Yeah, that's very true. That's an apt comparison, I think. I like it, though. I thought it was really well done, and you kind of see his, mild dementia. This is a very, benevolent, lighthearted movie. So even when you see him going to those sort of extreme places where he's contemplating suicide, it's just kind of funny, you know? It's not really, never sense the severity of it.
Yeah, and you mentioned that. I don't want to go too deep into spoilers right here, but yeah, there is a scene where he gets interrupted doing something that's probably not very funny, but then, like,
they ultimately laugh it off.
They're like, oh, This wasn't anything serious, but yeah. It's actually a really dark journey he goes on, as you know, he slips into poverty as well as probably a little bit of alcohol abuse. Well,
because it's him since, like, because he was the, you know, he was the king, like, at the time, you know, when silent film was around, it seemed like this guy was being built up, like, you know, he was the name of the game. But he was also stridently rejecting sound, and you kind of, that's exactly what you watch, is you watch his downfall, and you watch him feeling his own irrelevance.
Yeah,
as the story goes on.
And as I mentioned before, it kind of started out as this romantic comedy where she is this person who kind of accidentally meets him, like, at a premiere or something. Mm-hmm. And you know, he's outside greeting people, and she drops her wallet and has to pick it up and bumps into him, and they have like this this moment together, and she's being a ham in front of the cameras, and that kind of like prompts her to be like, hey, maybe I should be an actress since mm-hmm. I like being in front of cameras. And then they bump into each other a few times, and you see this romantic relationship evolving.
And I love how they handle that montage too, where they kind of show her going from like these very small supporting roles into actually becoming a big star.
Me too. I really like the way they handle a lot of the film related stuff in this yeah. movie, like her becoming like being like a bit part into like a leading actress and eventually the biggest star in Hollywood, mm-hmm. and also the sequence where she is getting like her first part in the movie, and he's playing the spy, and he's like has to cut through this ballroom. And
oh, then, the
like,
multiple takes of it. Yes,
I really loved the multiple takes, mm-hmm. and I was kind of hoping to see a little bit more with maybe some different scenes of that, because I really liked how their performances were changing in each take, and how you could basically see their relationship butting into a romance basically by seeing the same scene over and over again with different performances.
Oh yeah. And that's one of the things we haven't really talked about, is just how much story they're able to give you without any actual dialogue, just the occasional card where they have to spell out some exposition if it's a really long statement or something.
And they really are very, very occasional.
It's very, very sparse.
For how much, like, words people are mouthing.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're emoted so well.
Yeah, and from the context of the scene, you kind of know what characters are going to say what kind of line. Mm-hmm. And I think that speaks well to the way that the characters are developed and how well they portray these personalities. And it's never like as cartoonish as maybe a lot of older silent films, where they're not mm-hmm. like flailing their arms around and they're not overly mugging. I think that if this movie did have dialogue, we probably wouldn't consider them to be overacting at all. I think they walk a very fine line, and they do it really successfully.
Oh yeah, I do want. Oh, can I?
Yeah, go for it.
I was just gonna say, I think it's really, we haven't mentioned any of the supporting cast yet. For starters, the dog. There's that little dog that's always with him.
Yeah,
is adorable and are hilarious. Very, very cute, and I love how it's just sort of his partner that kind of tags along with him. He's just there for his sort of, I don't know, his vaudevillian routines. You know, he's got, like, these cute little moves that he does, and he's always there for, you know, a good quick laugh. If they just need to share the dog doing something funny, it's always there, and it's good. And I also love John Goodman in mm-hmm. this. I think John Goodman was amazing. And James Cromwell, who play sort of supporting roles, but if there was actual dialogue in this movie, you'd see that they'd get a lot of it. I mean, they're actually really big parts of the film.
There was one side character that I was they set up. She's played by Missy Pyle, who, let's get a little bit of context here. She was also in let's see, what is she?
A lot of sitcoms, a lot of bad sitcoms.
You'd recognize her if you saw her. She was
she's in Visionaires.
Yeah, she was also in the Tim Burton remake of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. She played the blonde kind of athletic mom. Mm-hmm. Anyway, she's in, like, a lot of those screwball comedy type movies and sitcoms, but she plays this character Constance, which I don't think you'd really know her name unless you were reading the credits, but they kind of set her up as, like, at the very beginning of the movie as maybe someone who's going to try to foil George, mm-hmm. but they never really pay that off, which to me, I was always waiting for that character to resurface and kind of give him a jab in the testicles while he was down.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, it never came up. Any other side characters you want to discuss really quick?
Not really. Especially just to go back to a great performance from John Goodman.
Yeah.
I actually recently rewatched Barton Fink. Mm-hmm. And he is amazing in that. And he just has this like, and it's different because in this one, they're both of these performances are very kind of a little off-putting. In this, he's very scouring. But in Barton Fink, you know, he's likable, but at the same time, he's kind of playing this sort of devil in a way.
He's very intimidating.
Yes, yes. And again, he's very, very, like, very emotive and very well at conveying the scene without ever actually having to really say all that much of anything.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, we can't really talk about this movie without mentioning the end, so you want to move into some spoilers?
Sure, let's get into it.
All right, so from this point on, spoilers for The Artist. What do you think? We'll probably just be a couple minutes.
Yeah, a couple minutes.
Skip ahead like 2-3 minutes, and if you hear music, you're on the right track. Mm-hmm. So,
well, one thing I did kind of already drop the ball a little bit by mentioning the fact that there is an attempted suicide in this. And I think that's a fantastic reveal. Like, where it you know, it shows him with the gun in his mouth, and he's like ready to pull the trigger, and then bang.
The title card, yeah.
But it turns out she'd actually crashed into a tree.
Yeah. and I think that some people in the audience were still a little bit confused about that, like, because they saw her in the tree, and like, oh, okay, he did really pull the trigger. I didn't really expect him to anyway.
And Becca was like, oh, no.
And I heard, like, a sigh of relief when it cut back to him with, like, the gun out of his mouth looking around like, oh, what was that noise?
Yeah.
Kind of thing. But,
well, and then she comes to the house, and the gun goes off in his hand, and they both just laugh it off.
And, like, the dog with his brain dead. Yeah, they laugh off an attempted suicide. I think they did a good job of kind of bringing that turnaround in the character, where it turns out that she's just kind of been supporting him by buying all this stuff at auctions and kind of giving him that last bit of money that he needs to survive. And him kind of feeling, I guess, maybe betrayed by that. His pride is very wounded.
That he might just be being bought.
Yeah.
And they could have taken it, like, if they really wanted to go a dark route where he felt like he was just this possession of hers. They didn't do that, thankfully. They kept the story, for the most part, pretty sugary, I think.
Yeah.
In a good way. I don't mean that to be in a bad way.
And they turned it around quick. It's like, oh, like, there's this weird shrine to me, and you're the only reason that I'm not, like, I'm not homeless, but, you know, you didn't mean anything by it. That's okay. He drops it very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Since we wanted to talk about the end, or since I wanted to talk about the end, we should probably get to it. So I don't know about you, but I knew that there had to be some dialogue in this movie at some point. And I kind of expected it to come at the end where they eventually start talking. What did you make of that? Do you think it kind of betrayed the spirit of the movie at all?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it's... the only other post-silent film movie that I know of that is a silent film is Mel Brooks' Silent Movie.
Right.
And even then, they do it as kind of a joke. You kind of expect it to happen at some point. And I'm glad they saved it for the very end. And I think they paid it off really well by first not introducing it with the voice, but by introducing it with the tap dancing.
Yeah.
Which they had that sequence early on in the film where you're still enamored by it, even though you can't hear the actual clicking sound of the tap dancing. You just actually like watching the two of them play off each other.
Yeah. And it didn't feel like a punchline. You know, it felt like a good wrap up to the movie where, you know, he's finally able to progress in his life. He's not gonna be the obstinate person who doesn't think that sound movies are just a cheap gimmick.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
well, through I guess that's kind of the point of it, is that through the tap dancing that he does, he kind of finds his purpose. He sees how sound can be effectively used in film.
And also, you learn something about him right at the very end there.
He's French.
Yeah, he's French. And that perhaps the reason he didn't want to be in sound movies is that he didn't want people to focus on his accent or his nationality. It's like he was self-conscious about it, because there are a couple of title card lines where he says that, you know, he's an artist. He's like, so he's really committed to the silent movies, and also that no one would want to hear him talk.
Mm-hmm.
So you get these hints that maybe that he's a little bit self-conscious about his accent.
Oh yeah, definitely.
And it's a really interesting reveal about the character. I kind of want to go back and watch the movie again with that context of maybe he just doesn't want an audience to know that he's not who they think he is, as like this like American action star kind of guy. Anything else you want to throw out there about The Artist?
No, just I thought it was a great movie. I really enjoyed it.
I thought it was a lot of fun too. I don't want to play this game with every movie we talk about for the next couple months. But do you think it would end up in your top five?
Top five? No, probably not even top 10. But okay. I did like this movie.
I don't think so either. And this is probably the only other movie I'm going to ask you about that we see that was released in 2011, because I don't want to keep on bringing up, oh, it would have been in your top 10. But I don't think this movie would have displaced.
Like, never a bad time to talk about Take Shelter, though.
It's true. I think it's relevant because this movie's in a lot of people's top 10s. I don't think that
this I saw the list. There's a lot of. This movie actually made a number of, like, there was a writer for Time magazine that gave it the number one.
Yeah.
Film spot.
Yeah. This movie,
for me, is a little over the top, I think. I don't think it's is that great a movie, but I think it's a very enjoyable movie.
I don't think so either. It would have had to displace Tucker and Dale, and I really like them both, but I think Tucker and Dale try something a bit more ambitious with, like, the role reversal, as opposed to just, I don't want to make it seem slight or anything, but it rather than just this kind of tribute to a silent era and a... kind of a journey of a guy resisting modernity that, you know, we've seen a little bit before. It was really enjoyable and charming, but I don't think it was as ambitious as something as Tucker and Dale.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'm making Tucker and Dale seem like a really ambitious project. It was just really
fun.
I really appreciated the role reversal.
Well, what's weird is that was your 10 spot, and my 10 spot was Melancholia. And, like, how do you even compare? Like, what is the commonality of those two movies? They're reaching for such different things.
Yeah.
At least I think with Tucker and Dale, it's a throwback to a comedy of sorts. It's a throwback to, like, Comedy of Errors, whereas in this one it's a throwback to the classic silent era of film. So
if you're just joining back in from skipping ahead from spoilers, we're out of spoilers at this point.
Mm-hmm. The dog dies.
What do you think of people praising this movie as, like, this sort of nostalgia trip? I don't know if... It bothers me because no one who is alive and reviewing movies was alive during the silent era. You'd have to be 80 years old.
Yeah, I mean, I know I watched some silent movies, but I'm not that, you know, keen on them. I think most of the ones I watch are, like, the pre-code dirty ones from, like, 1920. Like, those are the ones that I enjoy. And, of course, like, you know, Metropolis and things like that. But I think most people... probably don't have many silent films under their belt in the first place. I think it's just a fun novelty to see what the medium was like back then.
I think that there's a lot of criticism about films that really glorifies that sort of older silent eras or golden era of film, but no one who's alive now is really a part of it. And we see the good ones. I don't think we really get a lot of the bad ones. There were probably just as many bad films then as there are now. So to glorify an entire era.
Well, it's also the infancy of it, too. I mean, they're just figuring everything out with it. You know, it's a brand new medium.
Yeah, I think that it can be appreciated, but I think people maybe put older things on a little bit of a nostalgia pedestal sometimes. Maybe it doesn't always appreciate the praise it deserves.
But that's all you need to see Midnight in Paris, because that's the exact point of it.
All right, I'm going to have to do it. I'm going to have to do it tomorrow or the day after.
Good.
I'm going to check it out finally.
All right,
so let's go ahead and move on. We're going to move into our top five analgorisms. Am I saying that correctly?
Well, now you're saying it wrong. I don't even think I can say it.
Okay.
Anachronisms. Right. There it is.
Anachronisms. Analgorism. That's something completely different. Anachronisms. All right. Let's move on.
All right. What you recognize the truth? Tell me, what do you do?
Now out on Blu-ray and DVD, we have Moneyball, which we've already talked about a little bit. Fun fact about Moneyball, it came out this past Tuesday. The character Alan, you know, the ex-wife's boyfriend.
Yes. That's Spike Jones.
That's Spike Jones.
I know. We didn't even mention that. He's a really funny performance in it too. Where he's well, he's not even really funny, and he's just got the small role. But it's he's so he's squirmy.
Yeah, and yeah. slimy, and like he's kind of wedged his way into their lives. Like they got the daughter a cell phone, and Brad Pitt, Billy Bean was a little bit taken aback by it. Like, oh, you bought a 12-year-old a cell phone, mm-hmm. that kind of thing, and. Like the boyfriend character kind of slips into it, like, oh yeah, that's something we should discuss as a family. And Brad is like, that's something me and her mother will discuss.
Yeah,
it's kind of like a fuck you, Alan. You're a fucking douche. Also out now on Blu-ray and DVD, What's Your Number, which is that new comedy with starring Anna Faris. It's currently got a 24% on Rotten Tomatoes, so this movie's probably pretty bad. But I really liked some of these like the little snippet reviews on. What's Your Number? I think one of my favorites comes from Liam Lacey from Globe and Mail. He says that, once again, Anna Faris manages to be the best thing in another not very good Anna Faris movie.
That's a great quote, too, because she gets so many leading roles in movies that kind of suck.
Yeah, but I don't dislike her. Like, Ryan Reynolds is in a lot of movies that suck. And I kind of
he's endearing
like,
in them.
I kind of don't like Ryan Reynolds anymore. But I think Anna Faris is even in more bad movies. I think Ryan Reynolds kind of has a better track record.
Yeah.
As mixed as it is, but I'm just kind of sick of him, and I'm not sick of Anna Faris yet.
Yeah.
One other little quick review from Tom Long at the Detroit News. With her sweet diz and openness, honk of a voice, blonde pixie looks and absolutely feel. And I'm sorry, I just fuck that review. Never mind. We're gonna go ahead and move on.
I want to say that Tom Long's a fantastic writer, though.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just a terrible speaker. So also out on Blu-ray and DVD, Killer Elite. Fun fact about that: that's the action movie with Clive Owen and Jason Statham.
Yeah.
Also, Robert De Niro's in it. And fun fact, Robert De Niro is the only U.S.-born actor in that film. Why is he in that film?
I don't know. I mean, I think he's at the point in his career where he'll just do whatever he feels like doing.
Why does he feel like doing shitty movies, though? I don't understand.
I think he's recovering. I think there was, like... I'm sure I've talked about this before. Like, his period from 2000 to 2005 might be the worst chunk of time ever for a truly great actor. Like, he made just trash after trash during that period. But I think he's turning it around a little bit. And this is just, you know, is easy cheese for him to do if he wants.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna fault him on him being in a movie like Killer Elite.
I'm not going to fault him too much. It's just a curious decision. And he's got a good enough filmography to where, yeah, he could do whatever. And people will remember him as this fantastic actor who's been in all these fantastic movies. But there's, like, a specific age group that when they see Robert De Niro, they only have knowledge of particular movies, and most of them are trash.
That's true.
So it's and some of them, sadly, will never go back and revisit some of these older movies. So it's strange to think that
a lot of people are going to define him by Showtime rather than Raging Bull, and that's a really sad thought.
All right, so the last thing that I wanted to talk about out now on Blu-ray and DVD is An Idiot Abroad, which is the Ricky Gervais and Steve Merchant kind of series. I don't know if it was ever a television show, but it was definitely a miniseries.
Mm-hmm.
And have you ever listened to his podcast, The Ricky Gervais Show?
No, I haven't.
So basically, it started out as the show, and they had this producer who, this engineer who kind of just ran technical things for the show, little things. Pilkington.
Mm-hmm.
And he is just this really dense moron, and he says like some of the most like absurd things, and wholeheartedly believes them that they had to bring him on. And basically, their podcast turned into them making fun of this guy. Nice. And they have different segments like the Monkey News, where he brings in a story that somehow involves a monkey. And he like the one of the stories he brought in was like how the first life form, or not the, I don't know if it was the first life form, but like a monkey went into space before man, and how that the monkey was probably mad that he never got to go back, and like that humans were getting all the credit. And like how the monkey must be really sad and committed suicide when he never got to go back to space.
Nice.
Yeah, and this An Idiot Abroad is kind of based on their podcast, where they send this guy who's never like been outside of England, and they send him to foreign countries to see how he reacts to being in different places, places that he has very skewed views on. So I've never seen it, but it looks like a lot of fun, and I really like the podcast. There's actually his podcast is, I think, available on DVD as an animated.
Really?
Yeah, it's basically like an animated podcast where you're watching them talk to, like, at a table with mics, and they're like little animated segments. Like they'll animate like this guy's thoughts out to show you, like, so you get
the
a visual
of it.
Yeah, you get a visual of just how demented he is.
Nice.
But anyway, that's what's out on Blu-ray and DVD. We're gonna come right back with our top five anachronisms, as opposed to an algorithms, which probably has something to do with math.
While our consciences are sleeping, untroubled and unclean. This cool girl that I know went and had a baby, an amazing leap of faith. When I see them, she lets me hold her kid a while. Now watch the baby smile. Tell me, what do you do? It's inside of me and it's inside of you. Addicted to the sickness, it's an actual fact. All I know is I hope that we're better than that. All I know is I hope that we're better than that. Oh, we're better than that. Oh, we're better than that. All I know is I hope that we're better than that.
So this week, our top five is our top five anachronisms. Why don't you go ahead and explain what that basically means?
Well, in keeping with the movie we just saw, The Artist, he's someone that feels out of place in the sound era, and then he feels like he belonged to the silent era of film. So in keeping with that, I've compiled a list, and I love my list, I think these are great movies, of people that are out of place within their films. And I mean, you could be so bluntly simple as to say a time travel movie if you wanted to. I think that would be acceptable. But really, I'm just focusing on people that harken back or forward to a different era of time.
Yeah, I pretty much have written down people who are displaced in the time they find themselves in. And I'm trying not, I tried not to be too literal. There are maybe one or two, but I didn't want to just have this purely based on time travel. I also, because you could kind of also classify this as like a fish out of water type thing, I wanted it to also be based on someone whose values and views were considered maybe acceptable or standard in a different time. Also, I didn't include any like one last job, old gunslinger type westerns.
Yeah, I tried to avoid those too, and I thought about that, but there's so many you could have gone with, but it is a little too blunt, a little too on the nose.
Yeah. So why don't you go ahead and kick this off with your number five.
All right, number five. This is a movie we really liked, and we don't think it got nearly enough press. The Illusionist. By Sylvain Chomet.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, and it's fitting because he's not of his time, because he's this very skilled magician, but he's so underappreciated for his craft. His audiences are becoming a little more advanced. He's seeing the transition into the radio and into television.
Yeah, I remember one of the things in the early goings of that movie, I think it's he's like a duke or a prince or something of Austria, played by, is it Rufus Sewell that plays the, are we talking about the same
I think
movie?
We're talking about different movies. I'm talking about the animated movie.
Oh, okay, yeah. I thought you were talking about the Edward Norton one, which also may fit.
Oh, that's true. Well, yeah, I mean, because both are about these kind of misplaced in time magicians. Yeah. I would with this one, like, and it's also fitting, too, because it's sort of a silent film. You hear very little discussion in
yeah.
it. Very minimal use of language in it. And yeah, like that's really it. And you see the one girl who's enamored by his magic because she kind of thinks it's real. Like she thinks there's some tangible element to it. But other than that, yeah, you just kind of see how his art just goes completely unappreciated.
Very good. And I'll just to wrap up my thought, The Illusionist. That's the.
If you're prepared to riff on the live action one, you might be able to do this better than I could. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I can totally understand the anachronism of it.
Well, see, Rufus Sewell, I believe that's how you pronounce his name, also the main character from Dark City, if that puts any face to the reference here. He's, in the beginning of the movie, always trying to point out how Ed Norton is doing these illusions. And he thinks he's got it all figured out, but Edward Norton never reveals, like, his methods. Mm-hmm. But that's, like, and also the character of Paul Giamatti, the character he plays, he's also always trying to figure out how he's doing things. So he is trying to perform these illusions in a time where people are, you know, aware that he is just doing a trick, and they're becoming more keen on the methods. Mm-hmm. So they're not as impressive as they once were. And it kind of becomes a game for them, like, oh, well, I'm going to figure out how you did this.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that is not on my list at all, even though it has actually a pretty good pick. I'm glad that we got to talk about that movie at least a little bit.
Very good.
So my number five is actually the character of Joe Bowers from Mike Judd's Idiocracy in 2006.
That's a fantastic pick, yeah.
And he's, in a very literal sense, displaced. But mm-hmm. being displaced in time causes him to turn from like this average Joe who just kind of trying to fly under the radar into this guy who, by default, is the smartest person on earth.
He becomes a genius because that's such funny commentary from Mike Judge that everyone is just getting progressively dumber.
Yeah, and how, like, just basic sensibility is kind of becoming outdated and even scoffed at times.
Mm-hmm.
And he's using that extreme displacement to kind of express how that's kind of a displacement in contemporary times.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, Idiocracy, my number five.
Very good. Well, my number four is one that we already talked about, Moneyball.
Oh yeah.
And I think this is great because I didn't want to do all of these people that were just so retro. I wanted to do one that was really forward thinking but misunderstood in mm-hmm. his time as well. And that's pretty much what Billy Bean encapsulated in that movie.
Yep, totally.
We already talked a whole bunch about that, so we don't have to spend too much time on it.
My number four is from Terminator 2, 1991,
nice.
By James Cameron. Not who you think it is, though. It's actually Sarah Connor.
Oh, okay.
So, from the first movie, she gains this knowledge about what's
coming. Well, she's aware
coming.
Of the future and then gets put in an insane asylum.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And her knowledge of the future kind of puts her in a strange situation because she is aware of everyone's impending doom. Mm-hmm. And it does drive her a little bit crazy. It's frustrating to her, the fact that everyone is going to die.
Well, and they take her kid from her. It's just, things aren't working out well for Sarah Connor.
Yeah, in a movie about time travel, the non-time traveler is my displaced person here.
That's very clever. It's very subversive.
Thank you. I liked it.
All right, on to my number three. And this is one that, you know, I figure is going to be brought up if we're talking about advancements in film. Pleasantville.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Because in, like, the way that the artist was playing on sound, this one played on color.
Mm-hmm.
Where you have, was it Tobey Maguire and Reese Witherspoon play these kids? Who are themselves a literal anachronism because they travel back into this fictionalized sitcom world of the 50s. But then also within it, you have Joan Allen and Jeff Daniels. Jeff Daniels is like a shop, or he owns the... Like the
soda shop.
But he also wants to become this artist, and Joan Allen feels totally trapped in this 50s housewife aesthetic, and she's trying to escape it too. And both of them are living these very progressive lifestyles that just clash so violently with what people are feeling in that era. And then, of course, it is in the framework of the sitcom that is imploding on itself. And I think in the way that the artist used sound sparingly, but also brought it back in. Pleasantville does the same thing with color. You know, they actually show people going from black and white into having color, or like toned color on their skin.
Yeah. So my number three, from Pleasantville to Iraq, I have Sergeant First Class William James from Catherine Bigelow's The Hurt Locker in 2008. So he's not so much displaced in time. He's just kind of displaced in space. He is so comfortable in Iraq, where everyone else is very uncomfortable, as they would be. But then once he gets back to the States, he becomes so uncomfortable with that lifestyle that he just needs to get back. Mm-hmm. So, like, and there's a scene where he's going to the grocery store and he's just kind of overwhelmed by all the options that he just kind of grabs any random thing. Like, you know, that's good enough. Let's go. So he's someone who is actually an anachronism in normal life, but fits in perfectly well in a wartime life or death situation.
Oh, yeah. Cool. Well, on to my number two. It is Philip Marlowe from The Long Goodbye.
Oh, nice.
Have you seen this movie?
Yeah, a long time ago.
Oh, I love this movie. It's so good. It's Robert Altman, I think 1973. And Elliot Gould plays the main character. And what makes him an anachronism in this movie is that he really doesn't belong in this kind of seedy L.A. of the 1970s with all of these kind of narcissistic, self-involved assholes. He's really fit for life in the 1940s. He is like hard-boiled gumshoe, and you know, just the way he dresses, even the way he talks, he has this drawl to it, but there's this wit that everyone around him just doesn't understand. No one gets his jokes, and he's the funniest guy in the whole movie. And yeah, you know, it's a great movie. It's him just kind of unraveling this bizarre series of crimes that take place, and the whole time it's just so clear that he just is not built for this time.
Very good. My number two is Ed Tom Bell, played by Tommy Lee Jones from 2007's No Country for Old Men.
No,
directed by the Coens, yeah. And this
says it himself in the movie.
Yep, indeed. And he literally is just barely out of his time frame. And I think he's a really perfect anachronism because he's like this old sheriff cowboy who's, you know, used to being the law and being able to like understand the criminal element and just round them up and, you know, lock them away in the county jailhouse or wherever. But he is totally out of his element when he's on the trail of Anton Chigurh, played by Javier Bardem. And he realizes he's out of his element and just kind of bails out because he doesn't understand this type of criminal and this new sort of era that he's entering.
Mm-hmm. He's always a product of simpler times.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Where right and wrong were more, I guess, a little more easily discerned.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, on to my number one then, The Brothers Bloom by Rian Johnson.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Great pick.
Yeah, I love this movie. You know, Mark Ruffalo and Adrian Brody, they play the brothers. And it is set in modern times, which is interesting, because the two of them are sort of showmen at heart. And they really engage in all these parlor tricks. They have, you know, the Rian Johnson vernacular of just fast talking, wisecracking nonsense, and they're just their jargon and moves so quickly. They really play back to kind of old noir characters, kind of like the Philip Marlowe character does.
My favorite line of that movie was, you know, they're discussing how Rachel Weisz got out of the museum, how she talked her way out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how she talked her way out of that. I could ask her. How obtuse. It's a really fantastic little exchange that they had there. But yeah, I really love that movie. And they are definitely anachronisms of a different time and a different type of con man. But they don't feel out of place in the world they're in. Everyone either just kind of goes with it,
mm-hmm.
or they just ignore them and just consider like the two guys in the weird derby hats over there.
Yeah, exactly.
And my number one, I apologize because I went literal with this one, Marty McFly.
I have it written down as an honorable. Like, how do you not? Like, this is the first one that came to my mind. Is something that's truly out of his time.
Mine too. And yeah, just the way he interacts with the world 30 years prior, back in 1955. He has to adjust the way he talks, adjust the way he dresses. And, you know,
can't start you a tab unless you order something.
and that's such a...
I ain't giving you a Pepsi for free.
That's a really fantastic scene where it just illustrates how out of his element he is.
Yeah.
You know, for just taking a step back in the grand scheme of things isn't really that long.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's...
That's a great pick. No, I agree. Like, that was really one of the first ones that came to my mind. I had it on my list, but then I thought of better ones, I thought. Or, well, ones that maybe were a little less on the nose.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Because this one's definitely on the nose, but I couldn't resist.
Oh, yeah, it's a great pick.
Any honorable mentions you want to throw out?
I had time travel movies in general. I think, mm-hmm. You know, you can really go with just about any time travel movie, and it's a literal interpretation of an anachronism.
Demolition Man.
Bingo. That's a great one, yeah. That would have been perfect for this list, too.
Yep.
And it's not even time travel, it's just that he was frozen and then pushed forward through time.
Yeah, well, he was still time traveling, just, you know, in an ice cube at 1 second per second.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay, well, and also I wanted to give Mel Brooks a Lifetime Achievement Award for this category because of Blazing Saddles, you have the black sheriff that is totally, completely unafraid of any sort of racism.
That's a good example of someone who is forward in time as opposed to someone who's lagging behind a little bit. He's like the opposite of Tommy Lee Jones there.
Yeah, exactly. And also Young Frankenstein, again, someone that's forward in time as well.
Yeah.
You know, he's, well, you know, he refers to himself as Frankenstein, so that alone is an indication that he rejects the thinking of
his father. He's a modern man who goes back to sort of this town that's still very much steeped in, like, the folklore and the legends and everything. So,
and I love when he says his name's Igor. He calls himself Frankenstein.
Do you also say Frodrick?
Okay, also, Silent Movie. I don't even think we talked about this movie. This is really the only other major movie I can think of that is a post-silent film.
I think you did mention that one, where they say shit.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's really funny, and it's the same setup. Like, it's more of a parody of it, but, you know, they set up a lot of the visual gags, and it's so much more over the top than kind of the elegance of the artist, but I love it. So funny. And lastly, I got two more from Mel Brooks. He really did a shit ton of this. History of the World Part 1 tells the entirety of history, but from a modern person's perspective. Everyone has a modern person perspective in it. And also Robin Hood Men in Tights. That's my last one. Because they even reference Abe Lincoln, who wouldn't exist for 300 years.
Sure. I mean, you talk about Mel Brooks, you could probably mention a few Monty Python movies, maybe Holy Grail.
Oh, yes, you could.
As well as Life of Brian, possibly. But yeah, again, a lot of like those, how would you describe them? Those type of comedies, not exactly slapstick, but anyway.
No, there's a slapstick element to them,
Those kind of comedies use that quite a bit.
I roll up a bunch of honorables. Do you have any?
I do. I did just want to mention Unforgiven. I don't want to talk in length about like the one last job, Old Gunslinger, but you got to at least mention Unforgiven.
Did you think at all about the movie Knight's Tale?
You know, I didn't, but
that's a bizarre one. That sort of, and you could just say the Romeo plus Juliet, which we talked about a little while ago.
Yeah, those are two great picks. All right, so any other honorable mentions you want to throw out?
No, I'm good. I've said enough.
Okay, so that's going to bring this episode to a close. If you have any questions, comments, or different takes on any of the movies, you can shoot us an email. I'm John, J-O-N, at GamersUnanimous.com.
And I'm Ryan, at GamersUnanimous.com.
Follow us on Twitter.
And Tebow won.
Tebow.
Talk about Tebow.
Real quick, so you don't have to keep listening if you don't want to.
Yeah.
Email, we just discussed. Follow us on Twitter, GamersUnanimous. Like us on Facebook, GamersUnanimous. Follow our blog on my IGN, GamersUnanimous. Tim fucking Tebow.
This is wonderful. I hope he wins forever. I hope this never stops.
I know, right? He won on a really simple pass. How did they do it? Like, it's like the number one defense just was not playing on that one play. It was amazing.
Well, you know, then there's been so much coverage like on ESPN of the whole Tebow stuff. It's getting a little overblown. But the good thing about it is they have hyper-analyzed that specific play so much. And they say that the interesting thing about it is they ran that kind of setup, I think, 23 times, and in 22 of them, the only time it wasn't a run play was that pass.
Mm.
So they just lulled them to sleep. They really thought this was just going to be another up-the-middle run.
He
flicks it. God damn it, I love that. It's so good.
I love this guy. I really do hope he just keeps on winning.
and that's what's so sad. He's going to play Tom Brady, and I'm really convinced that he's not going to win. I think it's so hard.
I'm not going to doubt him.
Yeah, but then again, the Steelers are the best defense of the NFL, and now they're going to play the worst defense in the NFL. So
yeah, and you know, I can't doubt this guy like at all. I haven't doubted him since he started, and I'm not going to jump ship on him now just because he's playing the Patriots.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, I was sitting at.
It's the most exciting theater on television or movie in any form of medium. I love this shit.
No
so
joke.
Good.
I was sitting in basically the lunch, the community lunchroom at work, and there were a bunch of people in there, and we were watching the last few minutes of the game, and the place just exploded with excitement when they got that touchdown. When the pass was complete and it was pretty clear that they weren't going to take him down, it was just a zoo in there. It was amazing.
Unreal, yeah.
All right, so that's going to close out the show. Take care, everybody.
Later.